R.W. Rizwell, who was a good man. This is getting... This is 1941. I've skipped ahead, perhaps.
Well, why not tell us a little bit more about Bill Baker? Because he's
involved
right in this period.
Well, when Bill Baker applied here, he was a student at Washington College, Maryland, and when he graduated from Washington College, he was really at about the educational level of the average man completing junior year at Princeton or MIT, and he lacked some of the requirements the old dean of the graduate school, Dean West, had set up. He required that everyone admitted must be able to read Latin prose, which was absurd. We had to talk a lot of men into around that. I don't remember whether Bill Baker had Latin. He was a very cultivated chap, actually, and had absolutely outclassed the other members of his class at Washington College. So we said, when Bill came up to talk things over as a candidate, we said we had to take a fellow like that, no matter what deficiencies there were in his training. So we took him, and of course he was absolutely tops right from the beginning, and extremely nice fellow to have around. He had original ideas. He was one of the few graduate students who didn't just work on one of my ideas and carry out. He worked to some extent on his own, but it was a very pleasant and happy collaboration. He's always been interested in birds. And we used to go walking together to look at birds, because I've always been interested in them, although Bill knew a lot more about them. And it went on from there. By the time he left, I knew he was the brightest graduate student I had had up to that time. I had another probably equally bright man years later who's gone into academic work, but he was bright and didn't know how to concentrate. So we'd do a good piece of work in dielectrics, and then apparently he got interested in astronomy and didn't do much of anything. But I don't know, really. It was a very happy collaboration for me with Bill.
Well, he worked on molecular rotation in the solid state, didn't he?
Yes.
Organic glasses and...
Yes, and then he went on to make use of that at Bell Labs.
I did an interview with Bill Baker last year.
Yes.
I was intrigued when he talked about his work with you and his years at Princeton. He mentioned that he was a graduate student at the same time as Frederick Seitz and Conyers Herring, and that he was very interested in the solid-state physics work that was going on at that time.
Yes.
And I wondered if you were following those conversations and that kind of...
No, I don't think I was. I think Bill must have been doing that on his own. I never knew Conyers Herring, as far as I know. I knew Fred Seitz, but it was more after he'd left Princeton.
And did Baker stay in touch with you after he went to Bell Labs?
Yes, he used to come to see me every once in a while, and we more or less stayed in touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, as you say, he had a very interesting and productive career at Bell Labs.
Yes.
Over the years. And you might like to look at the transcript of our interview with Baker at some point.
Yes, I would.
It's very interesting. This might be a good time to move on to World War II, and you could tell us
yes.
a little bit about your team.
One more thing about Bill Baker. When I, after I retired because of old age from Princeton, I worked for the Office of Naval Research for about 15 years, and they had, I guess it was some special anniversary, they had a banquet, and they wanted to get an outstanding scientist to address them, and Bill Baker was the person who did it. Well, that was just...
Do I turn that off?
Yeah, I can reach it very nicely. Thank you.
Looks like it was bothering you.
What major changes or problems do you recall during the Great Depression? Did it affect the department and what research was being done there to a great deal?
It affected departments in that with virtually no promotions, virtually no faculty promotions then. And it was inevitably some bitterness because of that. It was all perfectly natural, but no one was fired here. But during that general era, I can remember W.A. Noyes came here looking for a job, and Frank Spedding. We could have had either one of them as, well, we might have, I think we would have had to go to associate professorship to get Noyes, and probably Spedding might have come as an assistant professor.
That was Noyes Jr., wasn't it? Was it Noyes Jr.?
Yes.
The son, yeah.
It was the son, not Pa Noyes.
Yeah, well, that's...
Were you involved also in the deuterium research being done at Princeton?
No, I was not.
Were you aware of... the work that was going on? Did you have contact with the people?
Yes, I think I was. But I was not involved in any way.
Well, that's a good...
I was practically a one-man show, such as it was a show, rather a very limited show.
That's a useful transition, the deuterium research into World War II, and we know that you did some work on the Manhattan Project during the war, and also some consulting work for the War Department, and then of course the Alsos mission. So
yes.
Perhaps you could talk about each of those in turn.
Well, the I worked on the Manhattan Project for 18 months. Well, it might interest you. I was slow in finding anything good, and I was invited to come up to work to the radar laboratory at MIT. Well, I didn't know a thing about radar, but you see, it was distantly radar was related to dielectrics distantly, and that. Both involved, the research involved electric waves, and I was all set to go. I went up, spent a day there. The radiation laboratory there they were terribly crowded. They were using the halls for offices. There were desks in the halls of the building, and I know quite a few people there, but people, all kinds of people were working on radar who didn't know much about it. So that seemed a pretty good thing to do, and I was prepared to do it. But then Hugh Taylor had a project going, just starting for the Manhattan Project, and he said, why not stay on at Princeton, and you can, there'll be no dislocation then, and you can be useful that way. So I did, because I wasn't particularly equipped. That was just really straight physical chemistry that was going on. We were doing barrier research, and I stayed with that for 20 months, you figured out too. And then the barrier problem seemed to be pretty well solved, and it was just going to be a little tidying up, so I thought I wouldn't be doing much if I stayed, continued longer. So I approached the radar people at MIT again. They said, sure, they come on up. But they said they would, they asked if I would like to go out to Saipan to set up a radar station for the Army there. Well, I knew absolutely nothing about radar, which I pointed out. And they said, oh, that didn't make any difference. I could spend 2 or 3 weeks there, and they'd indoctrinate me, and all I would have to do would be to prevent some high military officer from locating the radar station in a place more or less inaccessible to radar waves. But I didn't know how good I would be at control of a commanding officer, keeping him in line. And then just at that time, my brother happened to remark to me that he'd seen Sam Goldschmidt, whom I did not know at the time. I happened to run into him in Washington, and Sam had asked if I would like to go join them on the scientific intelligence mission in Europe, going into Germany as the Army advanced into Germany. And I was very well equipped for that, because I knew something about physics and a little about chemistry, and could cover both, and spoke a little German, pretty bad German. So, but Sam didn't approach me directly, so I called up, I don't remember the sequence, but I called up Carl Compton, who was high up in the military science organization in Washington then, and asked him. And he said, yes, he thought I could, that was a good thing to do, it would be useful. So then I called up Sam Goldschmidt, and he explained to me, I don't remember whether he brought up over the phone, that was a difficult problem, because in Paris there wasn't any heat in the hotel, and I would have to use up all my food allowance on buying brandy to keep warm in the Paris hotel. But come on down to Washington anyway, and see how things, look things over. So I did, and went down to the Pentagon, sort of went through the mill, and it looked like a fine thing to me. So I accepted it, went right down in February to, I used to go down and spend a few days in the Pentagon, and then just about the time I learned to find my way to the one room office that the mission had, you had wire go through hallway after hallway of the Pentagon, they got ready to send me across, and I was due to sail on to fly on a certain day, but this was a civilian mission that was combined with the Army, and the civilians had to have passports, and the State Department had been duly notified that I needed a passport, but they got me 2 days before departure time, and no passport had come. That's the way the State Department used to function. And their passport division was a national disgrace, really, run by a woman. And all the papers were just lying there somewhere. So my outfit called up the State Department and said I was going day after tomorrow. Please have the passport. Produce the passport, and they did. So then it was just a matter of, I'd been looking over in the Alsace office in the Pentagon, was commanded by a young major then. They had a lot of papers that Alsace had collected in occupied France. They hadn't gotten into Germany yet, and or they'd just gotten to Strasbourg, which was Germany at that time. And I flew across. I was definitely excited. It was my first long flight, and I don't know how much detail is interesting or not. I could talk indefinitely. I was going to write a book about it, and I have 60 pages written.
Oh, you have?
But then I bogged down, and we flew out of Washington after an extensive briefing on what to do in case of accident, and there were 16 passengers on an old DC-4 known as the C-54 to the Army, and they had a stewardess who was a 250-pound young man, a corporal. And we flew to Newfoundland to put down in, we left spring, Washington with a spring and the mockingbirds singing, and put down in deep snow in Newfoundland to take on gas, and had dinner in Newfoundland. It was my first experience of an Army mess. And then we flew on to the Azores for breakfast. Arrived in Azores in lovely spring weather, and then flew from there to Paris, where you could just see from the plane the smashed bridges, and we could see Mont Saint-Michel, which I do rather well, on the horizon. And we got into Paris at dusk. There were very dim yellow lights in the Paris streets, which was not supposed to be bombed. I think it had been declared an open city. Mm-hmm. And from then I reported that the luxury hotel where I was given a room, and I was quartered in this luxury hotel. The army quartermaster had taken over the kitchen of the motel on the hotel, unfortunately, and we had regular army food, which wasn't at all improved by the French, by the fact that French waiters were bringing it to us. And this hotel, this name slips me, if it would come to me. I reached a point, an age where I can't remember names. I came down to breakfast in the morning, and reported at the office, which was only a 10-minute walk. It was on in an apartment house, really. The army had taken over the fifth floor, for office. And there they had a lot of fresh material brought in by Alsace expeditions to the front. And I worked on those papers for a couple of weeks. I was slated to go into the Ruhr region.
Mm-hmm. Are you still going?
Lunch ready?
Are you still talking?
Oh, I'm still talking, as if lunch is ready.
Well, it isn't quite ready, but I don't want to get it ready ahead because it'll get warm instead of cold. But I can get it ready whenever you want a break.
How about it?
Well, we'll take a break.
All right.
I think it'll be better.
Okay, well, why don't we take a break, then we come back?
All right. Emily?
Yep.
Sure.